Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 446.
This week, it's happening. I am coming and doing stand-up comedy in Minneapolis and Chicago on the 6th and 7th, respectively, of December, and then the 13th of December in Seattle with adorable tiny Matt Myra, who's shed so many pounds.
Yeah, he looks great.
He's so adorable. So you should come see him in person and hug him in person. You can get your arms around him now. He looks good. He looks fucking great. So Matt Myra and I will be toddling around the country for 3 dates. Go to Nerdist.com/calendar to get info on that. Also, at midnight, we'll be returning January 6th to Comedy Central, and then we will be on all next year, Monday through Thursday, following Colbert at midnight. It's in the title. I'm trying to make it easy for you. So follow the At Midnight account. We still play games and stuff on there. The account is still very much active during the hiatus as we are writing the next handful of shows, but super excited to be back, and thank you so much if you watch the show. It has been a dream job, and I look forward to doing it every day for as long as they will let me. This episode is brought to you by stamps.com. Okay, there are a lot of things about the holidays that are not fun. You should try to enjoy the holidays and your family as much as you possibly can. But I know that having to go to the post office is not one of those times where you feel like, yay, I get to do this. Just do everything with stamps.com. Print out the exact postage you need from the printer that you have, and then just let your mail carrier come and pick it up. They'll do that. That's part of their job. They'll do that, and you should thank them. And also, give them a Christmas present. Even if it's like $5 or $10 or something, a gift certificate, reward your mail carrier. How would you survive without getting mail every day? You'd survive. Okay, you'd survive. But it would be a slightly less interesting existence if you felt like people weren't sending you. Then it'd be really inconvenient. So stamps.com, since we're talking about convenience, will make all of your sending super convenient. Right now, as always, there is a special offer when you use the promo code Nerdist. It's a no-risk trial, $110 bonus offer, which includes a digital scale and $55 of free postage. Don't wait! Go to stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Nerdist. That is stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist. I'm very excited about this return guest, Katie Levine.
Yeah.
Chris Jericho is a fucking delight. I love this guy. He's fantastic. So many wrestlers that I've become friends with are awesome dorks who just have these titan bodies. But, you know, CM Punk is awesome, and Jericho's awesome, and Mick Foley was awesome, and, you know, like, a bunch of other guys that I tweet back and forth with online are super awesome. And so, you know, so we had that kind of awkward episode with Marilyn Manson on Talking Dead.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, shit, if the next episode is also kind of weird, people are going to start dropping out. They'll take one weird episode. They'll go, okay, that one's a little weird. But if you do it like 2 or 3 times in a row, then people are like, I'm out. And they pull the ripcord.
Yeah.
And then you lose them. And so the last time we had kind of a weird episode, the next one was a professional wrestler, CM Punk, and a community cast member, Yvette Nicole Brown.
Mm-hmm.
So we had the Marilyn Manson episode. The next episode after that, a professional wrestler, Chris Jericho, and a community cast member, Gillian Jacobs. And they were so fantastic that I feel like they helped save the show. So Chris Jericho, I'm so glad that I've become friends with this guy. He has a new web series called But I'm Chris Jericho, which is at butimchrisjericho.com. And I just love chatting with a guy. Like, he's a guy that I feel like I will be friends with for a long time, just like Punk. So I'm very thankful to have had this podcast, for many reasons, but also mainly for a lot of the new friendships that I made. So here we go. The Nerdist Podcast number 446 with Chris Jericho.
Important spoiler side note. We got off on a tangent about Breaking Bad and Dexter finales. So if you haven't seen either one of those, ye hath been forewarned.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Congratulations on your other new show.
Oh, thanks.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's this one here.
Yeah.
It's really fun.
Yeah, what is it, like a game show type thing?
It's like a fake game show. So comics come on and we basically pull shit from social media and then make fun of it. The game show is just sort of a structure to shit on things. and then I sort of award these points, these arbitrary points to people.
Okay.
So it's pretty fun.
That's cool.
It's actually really fun.
How long have you started filming that?
That's been 2 weeks.
Okay.
So we shoot every day at like 4:45, and then it goes on that night.
Oh,
so
cool.
It's pretty.
It's almost like a live thing too. Then
it is. It's almost live. We almost did the show live, and then we realized let's not do that. And I'm glad we didn't.
Just in case, yeah.
We just we wanted to have some room to trim out some of the,
especially when you got comedians and improv and some jokes
you
work
don't
and
know what's gonna yeah and there have already been a couple where the comics have said stuff and we're like just comics being comics,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, comics on TV,
yeah, exactly. You wouldn't on live TV, you'd have to be like
well, you know that, man, you know how that goes on live.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You're the wrestling's live, isn't it?
One of the shows, Raw, is live. So same type of thing. Sometimes, like the change as you go. There was one time we were doing something where, it went on before you knew, right? So, yeah. Okay, I'm going to do this, and then I'll go, or whatever. And then you realize and then you look over and somebody's like, you're like, don't ever do that again, or whatever. But it's like, yeah, it happens. There was a famous time, like a Saturday Night Main Event. It was like the famous wrestling thing in the 80s when Macho Man Savage... Something happened where Elizabeth got hurt, and she was in the back room, and Hogan was like, they come back from her getting hurt. He's distraught, like, oh, Elizabeth, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. And so they come back, and he's like, okay, so I'm going to cry, and I'll go like, I'll go like, ah. And this is all on the air, like on NBC. I'm watching as a kid. Like,
oh, shit.
And then he's like, tell me when we're on, brother. Tell me when we're on. And then he's like, someone's obviously going.
Well, this was. I remember those days of being a kid and watching it, and my friends and I would have the arguments about it. Like, well, it's not. It's not real. It is too, man. Fuck you. It's real. Just like those arguments. But I feel like now, enough of the people understand how things work. The fourth walls are down, and
exactly.
So they put more open about it. But I feel like that's a period of time where were wrestlers back then sort of, was there sort of a code of like, don't say to the press that it's,
well,
not.
Let me break my own fourth wall. Are we actually on right now?
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. See, I didn't even know. Mm-hmm. We didn't have hi, this is the Nerdist with Chris Hardwick.
So it's the Nerdist with Hardwick.
I was almost pulling a Hogan on that time.
Did you pull a Hogan?
I did. I'm like, are we on, brother? Are we on, brother? Tell me we're on. What happened? I think what happened was, because I remember that back in the 80s too, when you'd see you kind of might have thought that it wasn't real,
right?
But you kind of did. And I remember a few times you would actually see. I remember one time I was watching some match where a guy said, "I'm going to suplex you from the top rope," and just happened to say it right in the corner, and then went and did that. And I was like, "Oh, we saw him talk," but you still never knew for sure,
right?
I remember I went and there was these guys called the Wild Samoans. And I used to go hang out at the hotel in Winnipeg, where I grew up, and wait for the wrestlers to come so I could try and get their autographs, right? And there was these guys, and they never spoke English. Like, they ate fish on the show. And, like, you know, the manager's like, they are killers. They do, Mr. Fuji, they are very strong. They don't even speak English. They are barbarian or whatever. And the guys would be like, honga, honga, honga. So I saw the Samoans. His name was Sika, the wild Samoan. And I thought, oh, I got to get Sika's autograph. But how am I going to tell him?
Like,
how
doesn't speak English?
Does he even know how to use a pen? Yeah. Like, how much of a savage is this guy? So I walked over to him, and I'm like, you know, I got the pen there, and I'm like, you know, I'm pointing at the pen with, like, Sika, you sign paper. You know, it sounded like Tonto. So you sign paper, you please. Sign. And I'm like, please, you sign. He looks at me. I go, sign, Sika, sign. He goes, fuck off, kid.
Oh!
And I was like, I didn't care that he told me to fuck off. I was just so excited. Like, he spoke English. He spoke English. And I looked around, and none of my friends were around.
Oh.
So it was like seeing the Loch Ness Monster pop its head up and go, what's up? And then go down, like, yeah, did you
somehow
see that?
They managed to teach this savage perfect expletive English.
Curse words, right.
He told me to, but that's the first ones they're going to learn.
Yeah, always. Of course. Yeah, right. You go to foreign languages, it's always the swears you learn first. But yeah, and then kind of started figuring it out. But I remember when I first started, my first experience with wrestling was I went as part of the ring crew. Growing up in Winnipeg, they would do these tours of the Northern Indian reservations, mm-hmm. in Northern Manitoba. And I was on as the ring crew. So I would travel with some of the guys, and there was a bunch of, like, I look back now, they're all fat and small and, like, you know, really low-level guys. But to me, it was like I was on tour with wrestling. Like, ah. And I remember we went to Riverton, Manitoba, and I invited this girl that I had a fancy for, I had a hankering for, mm-hmm. to come to the show. Like, come see my show. I'm setting up the ring tonight, you know, like back when that was like the cool thing. And so the first bump that the guy took, the ring broke because it was a really shitty ring, and the whole iron cage underneath kind of fell down. So I had to spend the entire show on my back with my legs up, holding the boards up so that the ring wouldn't break. And I remember the girl watching for a bit and then kind of seeing me under the ring, and it's kind of like this guy's a loser and leaving. But there was a guy on that tour called Catfish Charlie. And he was this big black guy and kind of did like a catfish gimmick, like a fisherman Cajun guy or whatever. And he ended up being my roommate. And he was the one who explained to me the secrets of the wrestling world and how, you know, when you won a match, you really weren't winning because, you know, the promoter was telling you. And I kind of like, it wasn't too, and this, you got to remember, this is 1989. So there was no internet. There was no way of really knowing.
he was blowing your mind.
He was blowing my mind. It's like when your parents sit you down when you're 12 and go, listen, the Santa Claus thing, it's all bullshit.
Yeah.
You know, the ultimate lie. So I kind of got that. But then I was like, okay, fine. So when you have a normal match, someone tells you to win. But when you win a championship, that's really you, right? Like, you're really winning the championship. And he's like, no.
Wait, what? Yeah, what?
And I was like, what? You mean, like, when Hulk Hogan won the championship, he really didn't win? No, the promoter told him to. And that was the bitter pill to swallow. It took me a couple hours of, like, I need some alone time to, like, really, like, like, holy shit, how did they fool me? I felt like the biggest loser. Like, how did they get me? But then that's when I started figuring out, like, oh, this is all really show business, and then kind of move forward from there.
Yeah, it didn't really affect whether or not people watched wrestling. I mean,
no.
Everyone knows now, but they still watch the shit out
of it. Sure, you know, because it's just a show. You know what I mean? It's like when we go watch World War Z or watch The Walking Dead,
Yeah. You
know it's not real,
right?
But it doesn't matter when, you know, when it comes on at, you know, 7 o'clock at night, you get in that world, you're watching, oh my gosh, you know, we were talking this week on Talking Dead, Rick banished Carol, and
Yeah. What's
she gonna do, and was it right, was it wrong? I mean, we spent a whole hour talking about these fictional people.
It is weird that I get paid to do that. I don't still haven't really figured out how
did you get that job?
I don't know.
That's right.
It's weird.
It's very weird.
But it's entertainment. It's all just part of entertainment.
Well, exactly. And that's the thing with wrestling. You know, you could, I remember there was a guy called Nick Bockwinkel that said, I could go in the ring and tell everybody that wrestling isn't real for 30 minutes and then have a 20-minute match, and at the end of it, everyone's going to call me a liar.
Right.
Because people are putting it aside. They're going there to be entertained like they do when they go to watch a movie or whatever it may be, and get involved with the characters and the storylines that are involved with it.
You were a great guest on Talking Dead, by the way. You know, it's always funny. Like, we'll have an episode that feels, you know, like, we haven't really had that many episodes of Talking Dead that I feel like, oh, I don't know, we didn't connect, or it didn't, you know.
Uh-huh.
But we've had a couple awkward episodes, and almost always, well, always, the two times, it was followed up by a wrestler, and last time CM Punk, and a cast member from Community, last time we met Nicole Brown. And so then the Marilyn Manson episode happened, and everyone was like, it was on Stern for 3 days, and everyone was like, what happened to Marilyn Manson? Rah, rah, rah. And I was like, everything's going to be fine, because next week we got a wrestler and a Community cast member. We got Chris Jericho, and we got and then we have Gillian Jacobs. And I already knew you were going to be great, because you were great the last time you came on the podcast.
Yeah.
So I felt it was so, you know, there was something to the sort of weird kind of energy that the Marilyn Manson episode brought. But the funny thing about it is, as much as people complained about it, it's an episode they will always remember.
Well, yeah. You've probably heard more about that episode than you have any other.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's, you know, everybody has to have their magical mystery tour.
Yeah.
You know, everybody needs to have their kind of bomb episode. But the thing that's funny, and this blew my mind, Chris, is that I've been watching Walking Dead since the first episode. I've always been I wasn't a fan of the comic books, but I was a fan of zombies, like, since I was young. And real in-depth zombies, like, you know, Lucio Fulci, Italian type, you know, those type of zombies too. But so I loved the show, watched the show, and I knew what Talking Dead was. And obviously you're my bud, so I'd always see you come in, you know, do the cut-ins. But I never checked it out. Like, I just, you know, I have other stuff going on and didn't really watch. I loved the concept. But when you announced that I was going to be on the show at the end of the Manson one, I guess, I have never had that type of response for anything I've done. Coming back to the WWE, maybe, but, you know, Tonight Show, whatever. This for the Talking Dead, and today even, still getting text after text after text after text. You know, you see the hat, like the you know, at AMC Walking Dead or Talking Dead, and it's just like, that's all I'm seeing. You can't even read them all because there's too many. People love this show, and obviously tons of people are watching it. And I was telling these guys before, I got not even tweets, but texts from random people that I don't hear from, you know, very often. Like Phil Collin from Def Leppard, you're the best guest on Talking Dead ever. And I was like, thanks, Phil Collin from Def Leppard.
Holy shit.
Yeah, Charlie Benanti from Anthrax. Like, all these you know, all these people that are my buds. But, you know, I talked to him from time to time. But, like, Phil Collin, I haven't talked to him in 6 months, and out of nowhere, great job on Talking Dead.
Holy shit.
So, I mean, there's everybody is watching this show.
Well,
and now I'm going to be watching it every week, too, because the discussions and the dissertations that you have about the episode was amazing.
It really helps. I think, you know, people just get cranky if they feel like that the person on, because they're really trading their time to watch the
show. Sure.
And they're very invested in Walking Dead. And it is just a television show, and our show is just a television show. It's supposed to be entertainment, but you do get emotionally wrapped up in it. So when people, I think people watch our show to sort of feel like a little bit of come down, a little bit of, like, you know, water cooler discussion, so they can kind of go back into their lives and kind of wrap up some of the open loops that the episode left in their head. And so when someone comes on and doesn't really provide that for them, they bums them out.
Yeah.
So when you came on, like, literally every tweet was, best guest ever, Jericho, you should host the show, oh my God. And I was like, fuck, man. You saw some things in the episode that I didn't. You know, your whole thing about, like, this whole episode was about everyone letting go. It's like, oh my God.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It really was.
But I kind of thought that, like, you know, that show is so specific with everything you do. I thought that was almost obvious, and I kind of felt stupid, like, pointing it out. But it seemed like I kind of did catch that when a lot of other people didn't. But it was too obvious to me to not have the writers have made that there for a reason.
Right.
You know? So here we are doing Talking Dead.
Talking Dead.
Yeah. but yeah, I mean, that's one cool thing about a lot of the shows that are on TV nowadays. I mean, it's getting to the point where there was too many blasting me in the face at once, because I love Walking Dead. I love Sons of Anarchy. I loved Dexter. And I love Breaking Bad. And I also loved American Horror, but that one kind of dropped out of sight because I was spending too much time with the other ones. And I can't watch two or three shows at once. I have to watch one.
That's all the room, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
because I need, like, Breaking Bad was another show that you had to process it.
Yeah.
You couldn't just, like, swing from one to another like Tarzan on a vine, because there's too much stuff on this show to think about for the next week.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, in American Horror Story, I've been watching the third season.
Coven?
I've been watching Coven, and it's you know, it's not as, like, I thought last season was great.
Okay.
Except for there was one storyline. I mean, you know what? Fuck it. I'll sort of spoil it, because if people haven't watched season two by now.
Shame on you.
Yeah, it's your fault. But there was this whole alien storyline that I was like, you don't really need any of that. and I loved the show. I thought the performances were great. I thought the vibe was creepy. I loved everything about it. I did feel at the end of last season like, oh man, they set up all this stuff and then they didn't pay any of it. They paid almost none of it off.
Yeah.
Which I think is just something that, you know, like when writers are crafting stories, it's like, it's really exciting. Like, oh, and then this weird thing happens. And then the audience goes, yeah, okay, I'm with you. And then they sort of just, then they just kind of let it go and go, use your imagination to decide what happened. Like, no, you don't get to do that.
Yeah,
that's why I love the Breaking Bad finale so much. But Coven this season is, American Horror Story this season is, it's just not, I mean, as much as, you know, I love Sarah Paulson and Jessica Lange is amazing to watch.
Amazing.
I mean, you can't
amazing.
Fucking take your eyes
she's
off
amazing,
her.
Amazing, yeah.
And Angela Bassett's really great, too. But it's just, the show is a little sillier. It's gone a little more True Blood than, like, the sort of dark gothic.
Well, it's tough for them, too, though, because they're trying to kind of link it together, but they're three completely separate seasons, right?
Yeah.
Three separate worlds, but with the same characters.
Same people, which is a really cool idea.
It's the same people playing different characters.
Yeah.
Very cool idea. But I think that's one of the problems I had with season two, was I knew I was hip to what was going on, but I almost really loved season one so much, I almost wanted to see, like, continuing on in that universe, but they went to a separate universe, which is fine. But something that you said earlier, I just wanted to see what you thought.
Yeah, go ahead.
You said about how Breaking Bad didn't leave anything to the imagination. And how do you mean? The finale, I think you said.
Well, I mean, he basically wrapped up every storyline.
Gotcha, yeah.
He wrapped up every single storyline. Every open loop in the story, he wrapped up.
Yeah. Yeah, which is great.
So I feel like that is a, to be able to do that in a very craftsman-y way, which he did, I think is a gift to your fans, because when you're watching a show and you get invested, you obviously throughout the life of a show, bunch of questions pop up in your head, and I think in most cases you deserve answers to those because
you're invested,
and it's also, I think, just even a trick of our brain. Like, there are some shows that still weirdly in the middle of the night I'm like, fuck, I never
saw that.
Deadwood,
yeah.
You know, like, yeah. I still don't. I just don't.
Lost.
Lost. There's one piece in my brain of just that. Just as a human being, my brain interprets it as a real experience. That those things just didn't get wrapped up.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. But I'm the same way, though. Like, I ask for when I watch a show is, and obviously you and I are intelligent guys, maybe not in book smarts, but when it comes to street smarts and pop culture and stuff, all I ask is just give me something that I can believe. I know it's not possible, a lot of things, but just don't insult me with major plot holes or things that are so implausible that I can't even buy it.
Right.
You know, and that's what I loved about Breaking Bad, that ended at about the same time as Dexter did.
Yeah.
Now, I was a huge Dexter fan, but I think Dexter was the tale of two shows. It was either the show that was one of the coolest, most revolutionary, shocking pieces of you know, film that we'd seen, and the other show was this completely horrible, plot-filled piece of shit that nothing made sense, and they didn't even care. It was like, you know, why Jason Voorhees came back in Friday the 13th Part 4? Well, because we needed to make another movie. Like,
yeah, exactly.
didn't even try and give me a reason, you know? And I think the finale of Dexter was an abomination because it was so awful. And I'm wondering, did they sit down, like, did Vince Gilligan sit down and plot out the entire last season skeleton-wise from beginning to end? And know that the last scene of Breaking Bad was going to be Walter White dead with the cops coming in and all this story? Or was he writing it as he went along?
I think it was a little of both. I think he knew where they wanted to go with it. I think he had said that he knew that he wanted it to end that way. But obviously, you know, just the roads that they took to get there, I think they did figure out along the way. But, I mean, it's really hard to introduce, I mean, the reason that Vince is so amazing is that a lot of shows will introduce some crazy thing or some crazy idea or something really shocking, but you see the real artistry behind a show if they can seamlessly justify getting to that place. And a lot of shows don't do that. They'll just do something crazy and
but
then
I'll
either
tell you
can't
why.
Justify it, or they don't. It's all in the visual storytelling.
Right.
It's all in the storytelling, and most of them just can't.
I hate
can't
that, like,
do it.
A Dexter finale. I don't know if were you a Dexter fan.
I was up until I thought the John Lithgow season.
Well, that was the one.
Amazing.
That's the crown jewel.
I sort of fell off the Dexter wagon a little bit after that. Just like you, like, oh, I got caught up watching other things. And, oh, I'll catch up and I'll catch up. But so I did not see the Dexter finale, but I heard
that... For anybody who did, I mean, basically, there's a big storm a-coming. His sister dies for a really lame, like, you know, medical reason. Like, she had a heart attack or something. Like, really, on Dexter? She's having a fucking heart attack? Like, that's the worst death ever. So he walks out of the front of the hospital with his dead sister in his arms and takes her across the street into his boat and drives into the hurricane. Now, this is a hospital. Yes, there's a hurricane coming and people run around, but you can't just walk out of a hospital with a dead body cradling her like he's carrying her across the threshold. And then he puts her in his boat and they drive into the eye of the storm, eye of the hurricane. And the idea is he throws his sister into the ocean, giving her her final rest.
Yeah.
And then drives into the eye of the hurricane like, you know, Spartacus.
Take me. Yeah.
Fine. Okay. Whatever. Not great, but I can dig it. End of the show comes. There's pieces of the boat floating in the ocean, and there's wood floating in the ocean, and you know, the forensic medicine guy, forensic doctor dead in hurricane, whatever. And then, oh, where are we now? Oh, we're on a lumberjack camp. And here's Dexter with a really bad lumberjack beard sawing wood and then going into his wooden cabin, obviously off work. So he swam from Miami to Seattle Canada. Or Portland or BC or whatever. How can you even? These are a team of writers.
Well,
that
you have to. Let's see. You'd have to swim south and then go through. You have to swim over the Panama Canal
and then there's border crossings and stuff. Like, how do you have a pass? Like, what do you do with this? And I was thinking, like, how did you have? You like that one? How do you get a team of writers who have crafted some of the coolest stories, and that's what they come up with? Wow. Well,
I think a lot of it probably has to do with, one of the things about Breaking Bad is that it was only 5 seasons. And
yeah.
So no one had a chance yet to get fatigued.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, Vince controlled that show from start to finish.
Right.
And I think Dexter might have been one of those shows where it
couple
shuffled
different
hands
showrunners,
a couple times.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
So it's sort of like they have different ideas, but they have to clean up whatever happened before. And you know, I think 7 seasons is a long time for a show. It's very hard because, especially in a show like Breaking Bad or Dexter, where the premise in and of itself is already insane.
Flawed, yeah.
It's already insane.
Right.
And so every season you have to create whatever the worst thing in the world is for that character, and then you have to come back in season 2 and start over and then elevate it again. I don't know how you keep doing that for 6-7 seasons. 5 is a really good number because it just, you know, at a certain point, you as the audience member start going, what the fuck else can happen to these people? I mean, you know,
especially in Dexter's case when, you know, his sister finds out he's the killer, and this guy finds out he's the killer, and that guy knows he's the killer, and this ex-girlfriend. Like, there's just too many people. Like, once one person finds out you're a serial killer, you're pretty much screwed. You know, but in this case, there was 4 or 5 or 6, and you start saying that there's too many balls up in the air to keep this rolling.
If it were me, what I would have done is, and maybe this is a really obvious way to go, but I would have come up with something that would have suggested that actually Deb was fucked up and had been doing shit the whole time behind the scenes.
That's cool.
And that she ended up hunting Dexter and basically taking the throne.
That's what I thought would have been cool, because you look at like Breaking Bad took no prisoners. I mean, when Hank got shot this year, that was the craziest moment of the whole series for me. And we talked about
that
quote when he said, you know, he said, Walter, you are so smart, but you didn't even know that they'd made up their mind with this 10 minutes ago.
Yeah.
And boom. And it was like, oh my gosh. But Dexter never did that. They never killed Deborah. They had her wounded and then died from a heart attack. I mean, that's why I love Walking Dead, because even Sons of Anarchy's done it. You just never know who's going to buy it.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously Rick's not going to die and Jax isn't going to die and Dexter wasn't going to die, but anybody else was kind of fair game,
right?
But they weren't on Dexter, and that's what you once the show about the serial killer is afraid to take those type of chances, it stopped working as a show for me.
Yeah. So. But there's a lot of there's still a lot of good television out there to watch.
Yeah.
So so that's why, you know, I feel like, oh, you know, I might have fallen off the Dexter train a little bit, but then that's when I hopped over onto the Game of Thrones train.
Yeah.
You know, like
Just started the Boardwalk Empire.
Boardwalk, I fell off after the first season. I loved it. And I know it got more intense. I just wanted to see Nucky be more of a gangster and less of a politician.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I'm sure that happened. I know that happened.
But like you said, sometimes you just lose track. You know, it's hard to kind of fall. I remember I did that with X-Files and with Nip Tuck. Like, you said it best. When you get to season – in Seinfeld, it was like this too. Season 3, 4, and 5 of those shows are always the best because that's who they really figure out who they are.
Yeah.
And then it kind of sticks around a little bit longer. And Nip and Tuck got horrible at the end, as did X-Files, especially when Mulder left. It's like, why even have the show anymore when your main guy is gone? You can't replace a guy like that. It's like having James Spader replace Steve Carell in The Office.
Right.
You just can't do it. There's no reason to do it, you know? But I think the 3, 4, and 5 seasons of every season, I bet you if we had a list of all the shows that we liked from when we were kids to now, that time frame would be their best work.
Well, now this is sort of an interesting way to kind of dovetail into wrestling, which is when you've been in the game for a really long time, how do you keep coming up? Like, how do you keep coming up with the storylines to keep people invested? And when do you? Oh, you know, I'll kind of lay low for a handful of months and then make a comeback, or I'll do this.
See, well, you can't really do that. That's the thing. I mean, it's such a hamster wheel. You know, you're on TV 52 weeks a year, sometimes twice a week, over and over and over and over again. There's never an off season. And the only time you're really off is when you get hurt. I was fortunate that I never got hurt. So what I used to do is I would always change my costume, change the color, change the style, change my hairstyle, change my look, facial hair, jackets that I wore to the ring, all that stuff. It's going to sound funny, but I always kind of considered myself to be the Madonna of wrestling. In that, funny, right? But you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
She always reinvented herself.
Right.
But still stayed true to who she was as a performer. But, you know, you got the Madonna, you know, hooker look, and you got the Madonna Che Guevara look, and you got the Madonna.
The Virgin look.
The Virgin look.
The Vogue look.
Vogue look. Electric dance, EDM look, or whatever it may be. And for me, what I did was I also, if I started getting mentally burned out, I would just leave, which was frowned upon, especially the first time I left in 2005. This is a segue worthy of Gene Simmons when you hear it. I left in 2005 because I was just really mentally burned out. And if you're not mentally into something, anything, but especially wrestling, if you're not mentally 1,000% there, you're going to get hurt, or you're going to hurt somebody else, because it's too physical of a type of form of entertainment or form of occupation.
You need to pay attention.
You got to pay attention. You got to be a step ahead. And that goes for putting together. It's like writing a show. I'm writing the matches that I'm doing, and I have a lot of input into the angles that I'm doing. And when I just stopped caring, my work started to go down. My attitude started to go down. I was like, I need time to leave. So my contract ended. I told Vince, I'm leaving. Well, when are you coming back? I don't know. Are you ever coming back? I don't know. So what I did is I came out to L.A. to start studying acting and start breaking into this world out here. But when I got out here, I figured out pretty early on that just because I was Chris Jericho, internationally acclaimed, world-famous wrestling superstar, a lot of people out in this town didn't really care, didn't really know. So I would go in for auditions with like 10 other guys dressed just like me, looking just like me, to read the one line from, you know, CSI Sheboygan. Boy, this water sure is cold.
That was a great episode, though. Yeah, that was a really great episode.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, next. And I'd be like, that's it? Like, but I'm Chris Jericho. Only get one chance? So I started to come up with this idea, like, what if Jericho got blackballed from wrestling and had no other recourse but to start over again in acting? He's lost everything. He's got nowhere to go, so you have to go into acting. But a lot of people don't care. They might know you from wrestling, but you got to start at the bottom of the barrel and work your way up. So I crafted kind of like this show that I wanted to be like a Christopher Guest mockumentary that kind of morphed into a Curb Your Enthusiasm type of a vibe when Curb Your Enthusiasm came out, and went and worked with my friend in Toronto and created the show called But I'm Chris Jericho. And we tried to sell it, pitch it around town. No one really bought it. No one was into it. And about a year and a half ago, he called me up and he's like, dude, I sold the show. And I was like, what show? And he said, and he's like, but I'm Chris Jericho. And I said, you were still working on that? I said, yes. So we sold the show and made 10 6 or 7 minute webisodes for this web series, But I'm Chris Jericho, which just premiered last week on butimchrisjericho.com and YouTube. See, there's the Gene Simmons segue. But
yeah, there you go. You called it.
I did. I told you. I warned you. But it fit into what you were saying. And it was just interesting for me to like go from the top of the mountain in this world to starting completely from scratch. But what it did was it also helped me freshen my mind and broaden my horizons. You know, it made me a better performer to study acting, to work with the groundlings, to be a groundling for 2 years and the improv side of it, and to learn how to commit more to a character and drop into these things. So when I decided in 2007 to come back, and I created this whole new character that was completely different from the one that I played before, that was based on Anton Chigurh from No Country for Old Men, mm-hmm. Javier Bardem's character. Because yeah. I was watching him and he was so like calm and cool, but I'm going to kill you because that's just the way it is. There's nothing I can do. And I thought like everyone at the time in wrestling was very much like, it wasn't as bad as Hulk Hogan. Like, let me tell you something, brother. And I was like, what if you did it the opposite and just talked really quiet and really straightforward, where people in the crowd would be like, I can't hear you. I can't hear you. But I was like, then shut the fuck up and listen, you know? And then they would have to listen and pay attention to what I was saying. And I changed it. I started wearing a suit to the ring, started using big words. Before, I was playing like this kind of a rock star, Y2J, happy, joking, bright clothes, long hair. I cut my hair and just completely shifted who I was and became like the most hated heel in the WWE, where people thought it was real. They thought I really was like this big asshole because I learned from acting class and from all the stuff I did to drop into it and commit. And when I did that, people believed. So that helped me keep things fresh as well.
Oh, that's really fun. Yeah. That's really fun to be able to, I mean, to a degree, you can sort of do that with stand-up. You can kind of change your perspective if you want to. Mm-hmm. But I'm never good at that because eventually I just go, fuck it, it's me, you know it's me. Here, I'll just talk the way
I
know.
Yeah, here's my bits, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's why I chose stand-up instead of, you know, early on with comedy, I was like, oh, do I want to do improv or sketch? And then I always realized, like, I just like the ability to break the fourth wall and to make mm-hmm. turns whenever I feel like it and not
right.
have to commit to something
sure.
other than just who
you'd
I
be
am.
Be yourself. And you've made a great career of being yourself. I mean, you play yourself on Talking Dead. You play yourself on At Midnight. You play yourself when you're
I do. I really do. Someone asked me if I was doing an interview and they asked me, you know, what is it about hosting? And I'm like, well, it's the same thing as stand-up. I just get to be myself.
Yes.
I don't have to say someone else's words, and I don't have to, you know, some people love sketch because they feel like it's a little bit of a protection, like they're mm-hmm. in a scene, they're playing some other character.
Right.
But I sort of feel like it's a prison where you're like, you're stuck in it. And if it's not working, you gotta
there's
just,
no way out.
There's nothing you can yes. do. How much when you guys, when you're in the ring or when you're, you know, when you're shooting stuff, you know, backstage, mm-hmm. How much is sort of do you kind of have general ideas like, well, I'll probably say something approximately like this?
Well, I mean, it's kind of similar to what you were saying. I mean, it's funny because since But I'm Chris Jericho came out, people are like, oh, so how do you like acting? And it's like, I've been acting since I was 19 years old. You're playing a character.
Sure.
You're playing a part. You have to. Because anytime you're in front of an audience, even if you're hosting, I've hosted a few shows myself, and it's like you still have to be the party host. You have to be the larger than life. I'm the host of the show, and we're going to make sure you have a good time and be right back. And you got to put on a little bit of a character, put on a show, and you got to make that connection with the audience. And whether it's stand-up, hosting, wrestling, if I'm on stage singing with Fozzy, you have to connect with the crowd. And if you can do that, people will always be interested in what you have to say. And in wrestling, connect with them if they hate me, connect with them if they love me. It doesn't matter. They're still going to be interested in what I'm doing because the cardinal sin is just to have apathy for any of that stuff.
Sure.
So, you know, for me, especially in the early days, it was a lot of improv. You would just go out there and just like improv comedy, just kind of bat back and forth. I give you something, you give me something. And when I first started with the Groundlings, they were like, you know, you're so good at improv. Did you have training? And it's like, not really. But, you know, back 10 years ago when I used to work with The Rock or Steve Austin, after the match was over and the TV cameras went off, we would just stay in the ring and do improv with each other. Just to give the fans something extra. You know, Rock would be the good guy and I'd be the bad guy. And we'd just talk about whatever and, you know, discuss certain things. I remember we were in Malaysia one time and he was insulting me. And of course I would give him little setups. He'd keep insulting me. And we were in Tokyo and he used to do this thing where he would say, you know, The Rock likes pie, you know? And this is Japanese people, they don't speak English, but they know the shtick, right?
Right.
The Rock, who likes pie? And I'd be like, I hate pie. What? I hate pie. I hate the way it looks. I hate the way it tastes. I hate the way that it smells. I would never eat pie. Well, what do you like, Chris Jericho? I like strudel. And, of course, that was Rock's analogy for a cock, right? I lick the strudel. I love the strudel. I put as much strudel in my mouth as I can, as much as I can. Of course, people are laughing, and Rock's looking at me. And then he's like, I say to him, call me an Okama. He's like, what? I said, holding the mic, call me Okama. Why? Just do it. All right, Chris Jericho, are you Okama? Which means gay in Japanese. Uh-huh. And when he used the Japanese term for gay, the freaking crowd was just like, ah, Rocky, Rocky, Rocky. And I had a great name in Japan, but the next day, the cover of Tokyo Sports, Rock calls Jericho Okama. It's like my badass reputation went down the tubes. But see, all that was improv, because you're having some fun afterwards and just playing these little parts. So, you know, we've always kind of had that element. You have to have that element in wrestling. Like when I started wrestling, I was a smaller guy. 5'11", 200 pounds, if that. And it was in the era of the Giants.
Yeah.
You know? So how can I make a name for myself? You know, everyone would say, you're too small. I was like, yeah, I'm small, but I can have the biggest character. I can have the biggest personality. I can have a giant charisma. And that's how I started working on my career. The reason why I was able to make it up to the next level and all these different things that I do, because I was always considering myself an entertainer. Not a wrestler.
Right.
I was more than that in my mind, because I understood what it was like to play that character and play that part and make people believe in what I was doing.
Well, I think it's really important to, in any kind of, whatever you're going into, whatever the field is, I think, you know, there are two questions that someone should ask themselves. Number one, you know, what do I like? What do I think I'm good at? What do I want to do? What's important to me? Well, that was like five questions. I mean, the meta question.
How do I count questions?
The meta question. How do I count questions? Is this still one question? Yeah. Where do I put the question mark?
Is there commas involved?
Yeah, I'm not sure. So you ask yourself all that. And then once you kind of know, like, you know, where you fall in terms of what you're into, then looking at the landscape of what else is out there and going, you know, how can I use what I have to be unique
right. In
that field? So, you know, it would have been a much different story if everyone was 5'11", 200 pounds.
Yes.
You know, but you're able to look at that and go, okay, there's all these giants. I'm a smaller guy. What can I do to fit in there and be something that's not there
right
now?
That's right. What can I do that's different? You know, and I think someone told me a long time ago, if you want to make it, you got to do something different. And that's why, you know, when I was a kid, I had two goals. I wanted to be in a rock band and I wanted to be a wrestler. And I never saw any reasons why I couldn't. But I might as well have told people I wanted to be a sword swallower when I said I wanted to be a wrestler.
Like, hey, listen to this Okama over here.
Yeah. Call back.
What?
But I just never really saw the reason why. You're too small. I disagree. You'll never make it in music. There's too many bands. I disagree. So I kind of focused my life on both those things. Now, as a result, when I started getting to a certain level, then, of course, now there's more acting opportunities, which fits under the wrestling umbrella because that's acting. And then, you know, I get asked to write some books. So that's also being creative, and I like to write, just talking about my experiences or do radio shows. Or I never, you know, last time I was on your show was for Robot Combat League.
Yeah.
I never grew up saying, I want to host a giant fighting robot show someday. But it comes up, and it's, like you said, it's not too far off from what I do anyways, which is just working in front of a camera and getting the crowd involved.
Yeah, the important thing is just to do what's fun. I always look at Will Ferrell's career and I believe that everything that guy does, he just does
because
it's fun. Oh, you know, I want to do this movie in Spanish. Fine, fucking do it. Oh, I want to, you know, be a part of this website and do these No, I don't give a shit. I want to do these weird beer commercials. Like he just seems to look at stuff and go, that looks like fun.
Yes.
And I think that's the best. That's the best place you can be at
with your
– but you do have to, you know, you do have to kind of engineer that a little bit, and you do have to make those choices. By the way, good call on Slash and dinosaurs, because he came on the podcast.
Did he?
And we talked for 25 minutes about dinosaurs. He was fucking awesome.
Did you tell him that
I
mentioned it?
Yes. Yes.
I wasn't kidding, man.
He was great.
Yeah, he is a dinosaur expert.
He was great.
You know, it's funny because I've been pitching this show about lake monsters for about the last year. And not just the Loch Ness Monster, which everyone knows, or the Ogopogo, which everyone knows in Canada. But if you go online right now and Google lake monsters, you will find one in every country. In the States, there's like 50 of them. And of course, we know lake monsters aren't real. Or maybe they are. But I want to do a show kind of based on the people that claim to have seen them.
Okay.
Now, that's the show for me.
Sure.
You know, it's not, I don't want to go on the lake and have a sonar and be like, okay, we heard something. Like, it's not finding Bigfoot. It's, I want to go meet that old man who stood on the banks of the lake when he was 8 years old and saw his dog get eaten by a lake monster, whatever. So I was telling Slash about it, and it's like, you know, and then he starts telling me how lake monsters could possibly be plesiosaurs, which, you know, and I was like, and I know that because I'm a Loch Ness Monster fanatic. So once again, a 20-minute conversation on the of whether it's possible that plesiosaurs could live in the banks of the Mississippi River and if it's possible to feed them. And it's like, this is probably the nerdiest conversation that two pretty cool dudes have ever had ever. You know, this is not going to happen.
It's here comes people. Pussy!
Yeah, because I snorted some cocaine off her ass.
Okay, so anyway,
yeah, the flippers, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know,
I really think it's plausible. They could bury themselves in the silt and then silt layer.
We toured in Australia with Fozzie in February, and we did a bunch of shows with Loaded, who's Duff McKagan's new band from Guns N' Roses. And Duff is like Slash. He's totally clean now, changed his whole life around. And he was really hungry, and he eats kind of the same diet that I do, which is like caveman diet.
Yep.
And I had a thing of almonds. So I was like, Duff, you want some almonds? He's like, oh, sure, dude, please. I'm so hungry. Let me some almonds. So he gave him some almonds. Later on, he came over a couple minutes later. Can I have some more of those almonds? I'm like, yeah, sure. I'm like, look at us. 10 years ago, we would have been sharing pills and needles. And now we're sharing almonds and jonesing over them as well.
These aren't salted, are they? I mean, these are just the roasted ones.
Yeah, yeah. Because I don't know that salt.
Yeah, yeah, the salt's bad. Sodium's really bad for you.
Gives you a bad trip, dude.
Before, when you were younger, you don't give a fuck what you put in your body.
Exactly. It's like, I'll have a yellow one and a red one and a blue one and I'll wash it down with straight vodka.
Yeah, never in my young life did I ever like look at the ingredients or any of the
fat grams.
I mean, you might have because you have a physical job, but me, I didn't at all. And now I'm like, oh, that's 170 calories. That's not bad.
Fat and trans fat and normal fat and fat calories from sugar.
It's low carbish. All right. That's good.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Here's the thing.
Sure.
Okay, so now a couple years ago, I went to dinner with my friend and his wife, and we had to find a restaurant that was gluten-free.
Yep.
Okay, I'd never heard of it at the time. It was only 2 years ago. Now it's the big thing, gluten-free. This kid can't do it because he's gluten-free. This girl, like my wife's friend, you know, 35, 40 years old, can't eat gluten.
Yeah.
Why now, after all these years, is suddenly this gluten afflicted us when it was never mentioned before?
I think there's a couple things. Number one, I think food is processed a lot more now than it was. And I think it's one of those things. Well, some people, I think some people who are just obsessed with fad dieting think gluten-free is like some type of a, so for some people it's not really an issue, but my manager is allergic to gluten, my ex-girlfriend was allergic to gluten, and the way that she found out was a lot of people were sick a lot when they were younger, and they didn't know why, and discovered that it was this gluten and wheat, and went off it, and it completely changed their lives. It was like with my ex-girlfriend, she would always kind of feel, you know, like if we ate pizza or whatever, she would just afterwards, she'd be like, oh, I don't feel good. My stomach, you know, like my stomach hurts, and it would distend. And
and then an alien popped out of her.
And then an alien popped out of her.
And that's why she's your ex.
Yeah. And then tap danced on the, across the thing, like in Spaceballs.
Alien to Spaceballs in 2 seconds.
That's right.
Nice work, hard work.
That's where I go. And so, but what she discovered was that when you cut gluten completely out of your diet, like some people can tolerate it, even though it makes them a little sick. But then when she cut it out for a few months, we went out one night and she accidentally ate a tortilla without thinking.
Mm-hmm.
She was like, oh, I guess I'll probably be okay. 2 hours later, it was like the worst food poisoning you could ever. So it's not, I mean, it was
interesting,
definitely, it was not psychosomatic, and it was not, I don't feel good. Like it really fucked her up bad. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, I'm sure gluten-free websites would give you much better information than that. But I think it was a thing. It was I think it was just a thing that was undiagnosed for a long time. People didn't really know.
And now they know.
Yeah, because like my buddy Will Wheaton's little sister, Amy.
The irony.
The irony, yes. Will's little sister, Amy, was always sick when she was growing up.
Uh-huh.
And they always, you know, we always used to kind of make fun of her. Oh, what's wrong? You know, got to cut you sick again? You know,
yeah.
Just thinking that she was a hypochondriac. But in fact, she was allergic to gluten, and they just didn't just didn't know what it was until they kind of identified it, and people got off gluten, anything with gluten in it, and then it, like, within a couple days felt transformed, mm-hmm, like their mm-hmm. lives were
different,
infinitely better because that was out of their system.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I had a conversation with my aunt about this, and she's like 80, you know, and she's wise, a very wise older lady, and she said, you know, back when she was a kid, like all the way up until the end of World War II, that it was the old school, you know, beaver cleaver. Mom would make dinner every night, fresh vegetables grown in the garden, you know, meat from the supermarket freshly cut.
Yeah.
You know, you'd have – everything was fresh and everything was cooked every night. And she said after the war – because the society started moving quicker. That's when they started with the preservatives and
TV dinners
and moved into fast food. And it was like this style of eating has only been going for the last 50, 60, 70 years, right? So maybe after all this time, you know, the human body is finally starting to revolt against that, rebel against it, which is funny because I told you about the diet that I started doing, which is the caveman diet.
Right, the paleo diet?
Paleo diet. Yeah. I saw James Hetfield from Metallica at the Metallica 30th anniversary, and he, like, I thought he was a James Hetfield lookalike. I'm like, fuck that guy. He's what a wannabe. And then he came over, and I was like, James, like, what the fuck did you do? And he told me he had lost tons of weight, like, in 3 months from the caveman diet. What's the caveman diet? Well, it's all meat, fish, chicken, vegetables, fresh vegetables, fruit, but only, like, berries, mm-hmm. no citrus things, nuts, but almonds. And walnuts, not peanuts or cashews, because those are legumes with a lot of fat, et cetera. Basically anything that a caveman could forage, eggs, you know. And that's, so I said, well, I'll give it a try. Like, if it's good enough for James, it's good enough for me.
Yeah, hey, the caveman, ooh.
And then, and the funny thing was, he's like, you know, well, and somebody I was talking to, and James there goes, well, yeah, James, you're on the caveman diet, but cavemen all died before they were 30. And James said, yeah, because the dinosaurs ate them. And I was like, yeah.
That's what happened.
That's what happened.
That's when man went extinct.
They did.
And
they
were dinosaurs.
But boy, were they in good shape.
They were in such great shape.
They were.
So they were delicious, the dinosaurs.
So I started the caveman diet, and within, like you said, within a month, it was like 15 pounds gone. And it wasn't that hard to drop that stuff. Like, I don't eat processed foods. I don't eat bread. I mean, once in a while, I'm not like super strict. But it's amazing how much, I don't know, maybe a little bit's in my mind because it's been a while, but I feel like a lot cleaner. I feel a lot more limber. I just feel a lot better.
Well, a lot of people who do sort of what they were calling the slow carb diet, which was you know, very similar to what you're
right.
At least from what I could tell, was very similar to what you're saying. Would all say, like, I feel a lot better. I think there is something to not eating a lot of processed wheat and flour, mm-hmm. and that I don't know, the people that I know that do it, they really do say, like, I can't tell you how much better I feel.
It makes, you know, it makes a difference. I remember, so
where do you get your carbs though?
Well, where you get your carbs from is there's natural sugars in the berries and stuff like that. And also too, in the morning, because I went and actually researched it a bit, the actual technical paleo diet, they suggest that you eat eggs with, like, bacon in the morning, because the bacon fat is equals your carbs.
Sure.
That's kind of, you can load
egg
up
egg whites
on
or
that.
Eggs.
Eggs,
yeah,
but the bacon or the sausage, like that type of meat that's you know, greasier with the fat on it. So that's kind of the cornerstone of my day. If I can have a really good breakfast, I'm pretty cool with the rest of the day.
So no bread. Do you eat? Can you eat cottage cheese, or is that off the?
Yeah, I mean, it's like I said. Like, I don't stick to it. Like, I'm not like 300 pounds trying to lose. I gotta lose 150 pounds, I'm gonna die. But there's no cheese. The official line is no cheese. Yeah, but I mean, dude, I mean, come on, we're human beings. You have to live sometimes. But the majority of the day, I don't eat any carbs at all. And then at night, if you know, I want to have some pizza with my kids, I'll have it, or a cookie or something like that. But it's amazing how, when you wean yourself off of that, how you don't miss it. And here's another thing. Stopped eating fast food.
Yeah.
A couple months ago, we were on tour with Fozzie. We were in Paris. I had some time before the show, walked around, was hungry, couldn't really find anything that looked good, I was running out of time, walked past McDonald's and saw a big post on the wall for a Royale with cheese.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, you know, Pulp Fiction. I've never had a Royale with cheese. I always think of John Travolta, Royale with cheese.
And now you get to have one.
And I'm going to have one. So I go in there and order it on computer, by the way. That's how they do their orders in France, McDonald's. And I ate that damn Royale with cheese. And it was like you said with your ex-girlfriend. I had the worst brick of, like, just this horrible feeling in my stomach for 2 days afterwards from eating that thing. And I was like, how the hell did I used to eat this
Royale
all the time?
Royale with cheese got me.
Yes, you hurt me. Why are you?
Because your body adjusts. Your body adjusts to it.
Yeah, and the poisons that were in it or whatever. Not to get too crazy.
I used to drink 15 to 20 beers a day?
Yeah, exactly,
you
know, man.
Your body fucking adjusts, and then, I mean, eventually it will kill you, but
just make you fat.
Or
you know?
Yes, which it did. Yeah. But it really, you know, the problem that I was having with those kinds of diets is that I was on such a carb deficiency that I would get the sort of like flu like symptoms that you get. Where you're like, I don't feel good. I can't think straight. So I would do it. If I found the cure for that, like what do I need to eat to make that go away?
Well, sometimes you gotta have that. You know, you gotta carb up once in a while, and that's when I just have some bread or some pizza or whatever. But another big thing was the beer. Like I lost 30 pounds in the last 3 years because at my son's 7th birthday party, I drank beer all day, ate chicken nuggets, stood on the scale, it was 230, and I didn't think I was that big, but I thought I'm kind of on the precipice. Stopped drinking beer, started working on these, you know, diets and yoga and stuff. When I look at a picture of myself 3 years ago, I was a fat fuck. Like, wow, was I fat. But I still like to drink. You got to have that. So I switched it to straight vodka and ice. That's all I ever drink. And I never get hungover. Ever.
Really?
Ever. Because I think it's the sugar and the preservatives in liquor – black or dark liquor, or you know, I'm gonna have a rum and coke or vodka and orange juice, excuse me, vodka and club soda. It's the sugars in that gets you hungover. Just the actual vodka, it has to be high class, top shelf.
Sure.
Can't be smeared off for that because it tastes like paint.
Jericho would drink nothing less.
Of course, nothing less.
No bottom shelf.
Yes, not for me. But if you just drink top shelf vodka and ice, even though it's first strong as hell and you'll feel like an alcoholic, which it's probably an alcoholic drink, but you'll never get hungover. That's the positive.
Thing.
That's
Listen,
the positive.
It's okay to be that way, just as long as you don't have to feel it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the important thing. That's right.
I don't know. I don't. I think, you know, if I hadn't quit drinking, I would have had to have switched off something other than all the beer because it just. Your body just can't. I mean, you know, once you get into your 30s, like, your body does not want to process that much fucking beer.
And it's hard too, like, you know,
it's like eating 15 sandwiches
it is.
A day.
They used to say every beer equals a sandwich,
yeah,
right?
It's like if I had 15 to 20 sandwiches. I would be hungover the next day if I ate 20 sandwiches in a day.
It'd be like Dagwood with the giant sandwich.
Oh, with the big giant sandwich times 20.
And that's the thing, like you said, I mean, it's also hard to give up drinking beer because it's a social drink. You and I go to the ball game, like I'd ever go to a ball game.
Right.
You and I go to the ball game.
I go to the ballpark down there.
But we have
look at all the dames.
And the gams, man.
Look at
the
all
gams.
The gams on those dames.
So, you know, you have a beer, or you go to a pool party, you have a drink with a little umbrella and a little strawberry daiquiri or something. You can't really have social straight vodka drinking. If you're drinking straight vodka, you're drinking to get fucked up.
Right.
You know, you can't go to, you know, for dinner and have a straight vodka with some nachos. Really doesn't work.
On a hot summer day.
Yes.
You can't fill your fucking thermos up with vodka and then just down it at the beach. This fucking sounds terrible.
That's what I always loved about Paul Stanley's rap on Kiss Alive right before Cold Gin. He's like, I know it's hot outside. You always need something to cool you off. Who out there like, needs a shot of tequila? Like, oh, I'm so hot outside. Oh, give me a shot of tequila. Ooh, that's better. That's refreshing.
You wouldn't be refreshed by tequila if you froze it and dumped it on your face.
Never.
Like, there's nothing.
It burns you the moment you touch
the
it.
The second.
Ever.
If it touches it, it hits your skin and all of a sudden you just get drunk for no reason.
Cool you off.
Oh, tequila was always the worst. Man, because I remember, from what I do remember of it, it's at least with beer is like a nice slow glide, you know, and then I still feel okay. I feel like I'm exactly. Yeah. But with tequila, you're like, I don't feel anything. Let's fucking knock over that dumpster. Like you all of a sudden you're just fucking.
It's bad.
Yeah.
And the thing is too, is like there's another, I wrestled a lot in Mexico where tequila is one thing, but then they have this other thing called mezcal, which is dark tequila. And that shit makes tequila look like fucking orange juice. It will fuck you up. And it tastes like an ashtray.
Forged from the rivers of Mount Doom.
Yeah, exactly. Tastes like an ashtray, man. I remember one time I was with this guy called Haku. He's world renowned as known as being the toughest, legit toughest wrestler. He's like,
but he only spoke in five syllables.
Fuck, off, kid.
Okay. Yeah.
But he was a really, like Samoans in wrestling are always great. And they're always big drinkers. They can fucking drink up a storm. And in Mexico, he was it was 93. I was just starting, and he was like, he used to be in the WWE. So he was like the first guy that I met that was a WWE superstar, and he'd now left and gone to Mexico to work there. So I was kind of in awe of him. You know, I was like, oh, it's Haku. I love Haku. I love Haku. And I would kind of do whatever he said. So one night we went drinking the mezcal, really bad. We were lighting it on fire. And drinks that you light on fire, never a good idea. It was called the Cucaracha.
It's foreshadowing.
And yeah, exactly.
This is what's going to happen to your body and your brain. Yes.
This is what you're going to be shitting out of your asshole. About to So drank the fiery cucarachas, which is cockroach in English for Jericho's Spanish lesson of the day. And passed out at 6 a.m., but he was on this aerobics kick. He wanted us to go. And this is a 300-pound, 6'5", wild Tongan, not right. Samoan Tongan. At 7 in the morning, after passing out at around 6,
come on, brother, we'll go for the aerobics.
No.
Come on, brother, we'll go for the aerobics.
And I get up, and like the head is the giant, and it's pounding, and it's mezcal, and there's puke everywhere, and I'm like, you know, I can't, like, he's gonna knock down my door if I don't go with him. So we go into the aerobics room and start doing the aerobics, and you know, you're sweating out like pure alcohol.
You could have
held a cup under my head and drank it and got
and it's
drunk
just
again.
At this point, it's probably just brown sweat from the dark liquor.
Yeah, brown dark liquor, and it was so bad. Yeah, leaving streaks across my face, like running Alice Cooper makeup.
By the way, people who are sweating out alcohol do not have the ability to smell themselves, because I've been on a couple of planes. Like I've been on planes like back from Vegas where the guy in one seat over, it just, when he would turn to breathe, it just like, he doesn't know how bad it is. Like your body is, you're an exhaust pipe right now, just trying to get all this shit out of your body. So you didn't pass.
I did the aerobics, but the thing was, he stopped after about 5 minutes, but he wouldn't let me stop. And because there was like a certain respect level in wrestling, I was like, I had to do it. Like that's how it was back then. You respected the guys that came ahead of you. And nowadays they'd be like, fuck you, Tonga. There's no way. But then it was like, I had to keep going. And then that motherfucker had me going for 60 minutes doing the aerobics. And it was bad. Like you said, not only was the alcohol coming out of the system, there was some gas involved that was happening.
Sure.
And he was laughing so hard, but I eventually passed out from it. And he had to carry me out, similar to Dexter carrying his sister out of the hospital, out of the front door of the gym.
And then he put you in your bed and drove into a hurricane.
Yes.
And that was the last we ever saw of him.
Now he's a lumberjack in Portland.
Cut to Portland.
Who is that crazy Samoan Tongan guy, and why does he have such a crazy beard?
Why is he such a crazy fake beard up there?
But that's how it was back then. I mean, it was the respect level. You get into the job, and a lot of us trained in Japan back in those days, and Japan was very strict on the Kohai Senpai. Kohai was the teacher. Senpai was the other way around. Senpai was the teacher. Mm-hmm. Kohai was like the disciple. So whoever you came into the job with, like Tonga had trained there as a sumo wrestler, then transformed into wrestling. So he was very much into that Japanese mindset. So he was my senpai, and you didn't have to, but if you had any respect and had any desire to really make it and get respect from your peers, you had to follow along with what they wanted you to do. And that was there was a lot of that type of stuff.
Oh, you know? Man, that sounds like a fun, you know.
Well, fun until you heard like the real Japanese guys. I remember one time I heard at the dojo, they had all the young boys stand around in a circle, jack off into a cup, and then the youngest young boy had to drink it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what's the weird part?
I didn't like the taste of it.
Spike the ball.
Yeah, interesting stuff though, man. I mean, times have changed now, but back when I started, it was kind of like that, very, very much into the respect of your elders. You must respect them.
No, we don't respect our elders.
Yeah, not anymore.
They're just gabby old laundry bags. Just won't shut up about stuff.
And that's how it was kind of in Japan, though. Like it's a strange society. I mean, very loyal, very honorable, yet they have magazines at the train shop of girls wearing schoolgirl uniforms pissing on a beach.
Right.
So they're very warped and perverted as well. But the one thing that's cool is they treat their old generation like, you know, our ancestors used to treat them with respect and ask their advice and have counsel with them like Indians, like American Indians do. Whereas here, they're just old laundry bags that won't shut up. And
yeah, exactly.
Smell,
but I put them in a home.
Smell like smell like lavender.
We really should. We should probably work on that a little bit, America. You know,
I think so. If you've learned nothing else from this podcast,
people got stories to tell.
They do.
You can learn from. You can learn from
absolutely,
them.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. I felt that the other day. I went to Bob Evans for breakfast, and I went in. There was an old guy sitting next to me with a hat on that said whatever it said, like D-Day veteran or something like that. Like some like this guy's from World War II, and I was like, wow, the stories he must have to tell. You know, I'm by myself, and he's by himself. I'm gonna go ask him some stories, you know? So I go over and I say, excuse me, sir, I see you have a D-Day veteran hat. Were you at D-Day? He said, yes, and I'm reading my paper. Leave me alone.
What you learned is don't talk to old people. See, you got a lot of wisdom out of that. They'll bite you. They will attack.
And I haven't had a chance to tell that story to anybody that would care till I came to your podcast.
I'm so glad you did. Well, that was about that was exactly an hour.
Wow. Dude. Clock watching.
Well, I'm glad thank you for making Talking Dead a great episode of television last week. That you bailed us out. I didn't think two awkward episodes in a row. People would have been like, "All right,
we're
fuck
done
you.
With this show."
It's already weird that you're talking about another show and that you get paid for that. We'll let it
Word
slide,
done.
But not two weird episodes in a row.
Yes, yes.
So okay. I appreciate that, and thanks for doing the podcast. And you come anytime you're in town. Come
no,
back
thanks,
to the
man. Thanks, man. Yeah, and one more time. So last time I got in trouble for not plugging what I was supposed to plug. I
think what you're supposed to plug.
But I'm Chris Jericho. It's the
.com.
The web series that is the funniest thing you've ever seen, or my name isn't Chris Hardwick.
Your name is not Chris Hardwick.
Oh, shit. I screwed that
damn
up again.
It.
Damn it. Fuck.
I don't know. Okay, we'll just edit that to make it seem. There we go. And then you're I Am Jericho on the
Twitter. I Am Jericho on the Twitter. Yes, man. Absolutely. And you're the Nerdist.
I am.
Nerdist at the Twitter.
And
did you ever have any brand recognition problems at the start when you first called yourself that?
Well, it wasn't really. I mean, I was basically trying to. You know, I started the website, so it was really just a way to make everything
promote that website
about the website. So it just made sense. Like, oh, I'll just make it all. I think it actually cut down confusion because it wasn't me. Because I have at Hardwick, I just never use it.
Right.
It was not me going, oh, but this is my website. It was just like, oh, I'll just make everything the same name and the podcast and everything, so people know that it's all part of the same thing. And it didn't. You know, it didn't. It always takes a little bit of time for people to go, what? What? Oh, okay.
Oh, that's
but,
the
you know, they
guy.
Will, if you stick with it, they will
of
get
course.
It eventually.
If you build it, they will come.
Yeah, yeah,
those
eventually.
Stupid sheep.
Wait, shh, no, they're still recording.
I thought we were off the air.
No.
What?
Don't tell the sheep.
I feel like Hulk Hogan with Elizabeth.
Quick,
all over again.
From Babe. Baram, you.
Enjoy your burrito.
Sweet. Awesome.
Cool, man. That was a blast.
Thank you so much. Oh, it's so good to see you, man.
And it's good to see you, man.
Anytime.
It's always fun having conversations. We never know where we're going.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com, click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist for a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just three simple ingredients. Popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.